This is Winfield Bible Camp 1998, Day 5. Our general theme is Next Year in Jerusalem. Our speaker this morning is Brother Chris Sales, whose topic is Jerusalem, Trodden Down, and Future Glory. His subtitle for this class, The Future Glory. Brother Chris.
Good morning, my dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, dear young people and friends. Well, today's going to be a little different because we're switching from history to prophecy. Now, if yesterday's class you found somewhat exciting, and I hope you did, some did. They said they did feel tingles as they thought of Israel coming back into the land. How much more, brethren and sisters, when we think of the future? I don't think we're going to say anything new today. I don't think you're going to hear anything that you haven't heard, perhaps, in a public lecture as we consider the future. But hopefully with the history that we've been looking through and the background that we've had, hopefully we can be a little more excited and perhaps a little renewed again in some of the things that we know to be true and we know to be coming on the earth. Now, having said that, looking at prophecy is a little different because you can't always be absolutely sure. We can only go on what the Word of God gives us. And I hope today that we can be excited about the events that will soon come to pass, God willing, on this earth. Now, throughout this week, we have been looking at earthly Jerusalem. And we will continue to do so this morning as we see what the prospects of that city are on into the future. And just by way of introduction, I would like to say that there is a heavenly Jerusalem that we have alluded to, especially at the beginning of the week in the exhortation. There is a heavenly Jerusalem that has existed in the past, in the present, and in the future. It's a temple of the Lord, a temple of people made up of people, believers in Christ, brethren and sisters, down through the ages of time, that will be manifest to the earth, to the world, when Christ returns. That heavenly Jerusalem is a bride adorned for a husband that comes down and is established throughout the world. Really, that would be a study unto itself. We could spend a week looking at heavenly Jerusalem, Revelation 21, 22, and so on, and other passages. You are a holy temple unto the Lord, and so on. But we'd like to, this morning, look at the future glory of earthly Jerusalem, the literal Jerusalem, the city of the great king. And to do so, what we'd like to do is look at Zechariah 14. So if you'll notice in your notes, starting on page 24, basically we have a verse-by-verse, not in detail, but a verse-by-verse summary of some of the key points found in Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14 is really a remarkable chapter. I think it pulls together a lot of these ideas about the end times. Now, the other thing is, we haven't done a whole lot of Bible passage looking up throughout the week in my particular class, because we have been looking at some historical facts. We're going to try and make up for that today. You're going to be looking up a fair number of passages. In fact, as we go, there's a few key places we're going to go into again and again and again, and you may want to have some markers handy. Certainly here in Zechariah 14, Joel chapter 3, Ezekiel 38, Zephaniah chapter 3. As we come to these places, you may just want to have something to stick in there, because there are some obvious connections in some of these places, and you're going to need a few fingers here and there as we flip back and forth. So I do hope that you can feel excited about what we're going to look at, and with anticipation, and it's rather fitting, really, as we leave the Bible school, that we have a vision of what is going to come to pass on in that place and on this earth in the near future. So we begin in Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 1. Behold, the day of the Lord, or the day of Yahweh, cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. The day of Yahweh is a catchphrase, and as we teach our friends in the Learn to Read the Bible Effectively seminars, these are the kind of phrases that you need to look for. It's a flag, and it's a flag for the last days. I'd just like to sort of look up one of the passages we have. But let's go to Isaiah chapter 2. We know Isaiah chapter 2 quite well, for the beginning of the chapter that we quote quite often, speaking of the last days, well, speaking of the kingdom age, really. But it's important to see that the day of Yahweh is linked with the last days. There have been, it's true, several days of judgment that are sometimes called the day of Yahweh, but the day, future tense, is the last days, as we've called them. Isaiah 2, verse 2, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. We can quote those words almost verbatim, can't we? So there it is, the last days. And if you just look over in verse 12, it says, for the day of Yahweh of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. So the last days and the days of Yahweh are synonymous then, the day of Yahweh. God's judgment upon this earth when he brings about his plan to fill the earth with his glory as the waters cover the sea. And so that sort of sets the time period for us then when we come back to Zechariah 14. It's the last days. Days that are still future for us. It's also called a time of trouble, time of Jacob's trouble. And we won't look that up now, but we won't look up everything that are on these pages, brothers and sisters. We'll try and hit some of the highlights. You can fill in the gaps later in your own time. So what's going to happen in this day of Yahweh? Verse 2 of Zechariah 14 says, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. So all nations are gathered against Jerusalem to battle. Let's now go to one of the markings you're going to want to leave, Joel 3. Just flip back to Joel 3 and stick a bit of paper there. We'll come back here a few times. Nations gathered against Jerusalem. In Joel chapter 3, verse 1 gives us a bit of the context, helps us to say, yes, this is our time. And we hope to bring this out to the teenagers when we speak to them next. But, you know, we are living in a privileged time. This is our time. The things we're talking about today, many of them, although brethren and sisters felt, 60, 70 years ago that they were living in near to Christ's return, you couldn't really have seen some of these things. Like verse 1, for behold, in those days and in that time, when I bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. These are modern events, 1948, 1967. The captivity is brought again. And in that time, verse 2, I will also gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. We look over at verse 9 to see again why they're gathered again to Jerusalem. In this situation, it's for war. Verse 9, proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war, wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords. The opposite of what we read in Isaiah 2. So before this time, they'll be beating plowshares into swords, pruning hooks into spears. And doesn't that speak of today's time with all the technology and all the opportunity that they could have to feed the world, the millions and billions of dollars that's spent on armament, and then we have people starving to death. They're beating their plowshares into swords now. The weak are saying, I am strong. We have a button we can push which will launch a nuclear missile. So we may not have much, but we have our finger on a button. And we are strong, therefore. You got to listen to us. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Yahweh. So the nations are gathered for war at Jerusalem. And I thought it was interesting, brethren and sisters, and just a little aside that you might want to add to your notes, that initially, the nations are gathered together against Jerusalem for war, which we see in Zechariah 14 and verse 2. But over in verse 16 of Zechariah 14, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship. So those nations that were gathered against, or gathered to Jerusalem against them in war, those same peoples later, when instead of its being plowshares into swords, it'll be swords into plowshares, a time of peace and prosperity and agriculture and plenty for all, at that time they will come again to Jerusalem. But this time it will be to worship. There's another passage in Jeremiah which speaks of the same thing. Jeremiah chapter 3. And so, let's go there now. Jeremiah chapter 3. So we have a phrase, nations coming to Jerusalem, initially for war, destruction. We're not sure exactly what the cause may be. We'll be in Ezekiel 38 at some point this morning. And that's interesting, that evil thought that perhaps is thought of why they come down. But later they'll come against Jerusalem in peace. They'll come to Jerusalem. Jeremiah 3:17. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Yahweh, and all nations shall be gathered unto it. It's the same language. But at this time they're calling it the throne of Yahweh. They will be gathered unto it to the name of Yahweh to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart. And so, yes, the nations will come again, but this time to worship, to say, let's hear the law proclaimed from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And so the nations are gathered to Jerusalem first to fight and later to worship. We can see from Zechariah 14, verse 2, that they have some success as they come against Jerusalem the first time. As we've said here in the notes, the invaders have limited success. We see that the city is taken, the houses are rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city are taken, but there's a residue of the people that are left in the city. At this point, let's go to Ezekiel 38, please. I promised you we'd make up for not looking at many passages during the week, so here we go. Ezekiel 38, we can see that there is some, as we say here, limited success. The nations, this conglomerate of nations, which we have a little more detail of here in Ezekiel 38, and I don't want to go through too much detail here. We've probably heard this, but we do have a list of people. We can see this Gog, who's spoken to in verse 2, is the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. So we can see it's a northern confederacy led by Russia. Verse 5 lists some other of the nations: Persia, which would be Iran or Iraq, Ethiopia, Libya, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma, which would be Turkey, the north quarters, there we go. And you can see in verse 8 there, and after many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. This is the day of Yahweh, the last days, the latter years. See the catchphrase that connects these passages. Thou shalt come unto the land that is brought back from the sword, which is gathered out of many people, against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations. And they shall dwell safely, all of them. Again, brethren and sisters, this has to be our time period, this century. It couldn't have been before this, because there wasn't a place called Israel for there to be a place, the mountains of Israel. They hadn't been gathered back from the sword. And so these are our recent events. And you can see in verse 9, they come like a storm and a cloud to cover the lands, many people. And they think this evil thought in verse 10. Verse 11, thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them, dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, and dwell in the midst of the land, or the navel of the land. There's something there now worth having, which they want. And of course, this appeal from it would seem the West, Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, they say, you know, what are you doing? Are you coming to take a spoil? And so we can see that they're designed to have gold and silver and cattle and goods and so on, a great spoil. We can see they have some limited success. As Zechariah tells us, they do take the city, which means they must have had some success also in the rest of the land as they came down from the north. Now, just a little interesting aside here, the end of verse 11 there, that Israel is dwelling safely, without walls, having neither bars nor gates. Just a comment on that. That's caused some struggle for some. You know, have we seen that? Or is there something yet we need to see in the land of Israel? You've probably heard that the word safely, as the margin in the authorized version here, says confidently. Okay, maybe that's a little bit of a help. They're dwelling confidently. And certainly if you talk to Jews, if you go to the land of Israel, if you read their newspapers, there is an element of confidence that they have there in the land. But what about this dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates? If you wouldn't mind just going over to Isaiah chapter 26. I think, brothers and sisters, we can say without a shadow of a doubt that Israel currently is dwelling without bars and gates. In this context, Isaiah 26, the first four verses. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in Yahweh is everlasting strength. And it goes on. Brothers and sisters, today Israel does not trust in the Lord. They haven't even accepted their true Messiah. It says that salvation will be there for walls and bulwarks. The gates will be open for the righteous nation which keepeth truth. This is not a situation in which Israel dwells today. They are there in unbelief. They're there in the might of their own hand, the superiority of their air force, and so on. Dwelling without bars and gates currently is dwelling without a true knowledge of their God, an appreciation of what he's done for them. Go over to chapter 60 of Isaiah, just to maybe reinforce this point. So are they a land that is currently dwelling confidently, proudly, without acknowledging their God, without true salvation? Yes, they are. Isaiah 60, verse 18, violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders. But thou shalt call thy walls salvation, and thy gates praise. And currently, brethren and sisters, the Jews in the land are dwelling without bars or gates and without walls. They're dwelling without God, without true salvation, without praise. And so the invaders have limited success. And we back in Zechariah 14, we see that there is a captivity. There is only a remnant that are left. The residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And we've suggested here in our notes that Israel is purged. There's a humbling process. There's a residue that's left. There's a certain number that are cut off. The suggestion being that we're trying to make here, brothers and sisters, is that remnant that are left will be brought to their knees. They'll be humbled. They'll be prepared, and so that when Christ returns, they will accept him. So it's appropriate that God allows these invading nations to have some success so the Jews realize they can't do it on their own. They do need walls and gates and bars from God. They need help. They need their Messiah, and that's what they'll be looking for. They'll be surprised to find out who it is. Let's just try and reinforce this. If you go to, we'll look up both these passages that we've got on our notes. Zephaniah, first of all. Zephaniah chapter 3. Zephaniah is a wonderful prophecy. It's amazing how many connections there are three short chapters, but just chock full of latter-day implications and guides for us. But look, let's look at it at this point here, Zephaniah chapter 3. And you may want to pop a little marker in here as well. Let's look at this from the context of Israel being purged, that the success that the invader had is for the benefit of the people. Yes, there may be some people who will lose their life, and God works that way all down through the ages of time, but if necessary, some will suffer that the ultimate good will come to the fore. And starting at verse 11, in that day, there's that phrase, that day, shall thou not be ashamed for all thy doings wherein thou hast transgressed against me. For then will I take away out of the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride, and thou shalt no more be haughty because of my holy mountain. I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and a poor people, and they shall trust in the name of Yahweh. The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. That's the purpose of this time of Jacob's trouble, this distress, this great tribulation, such as there's never been before. It's so that this attitude is brought, and so they will be humbled to accept their Messiah. And just to see the response of the people when they do realize who their Savior is, over to Zechariah chapter 12, and this won't be new to you, but think of it in this context. This kind of response. Our brother Preet has been telling us to sort of get into the Scriptures and live the lives of those who have lived in the past. Here, let's cast our mind forward and think of yourself as a Jew who's been living in the land, perhaps cutting out an existence from the strength of your own hand, holding back the adversary and getting into the land and digging in the soil and so on and bringing something out of nothing. And all of a sudden, you're absolutely brought to your knees. And you realize you can't do it on your own. The invader is running roughshod over the land. And verse 9 of Zechariah chapter 12, it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that came against Jerusalem. Okay, so all these nations come against Jerusalem, the people are brought to their knees, and God will wrought a great salvation. Verse 10, I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. They shall look upon me whom they've pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for the only son, and shall be in bitterness for him that as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. And it goes on, and you can see this almost dispersion a little bit of the people as they go apart, each one to their own house, to their own quarters, and they weep bitterly. Can't you imagine the scene? This is one situation where I can imagine what's going to happen. The people are saved, miraculously. And they say, who is this King of Glory, our Messiah? Who is it that's delivered us? And he stretches out his arms, and they say, what are the wounds that you have in your hands? And it's what I received in the house of my friends. And they realize, and they finally look on him whom they pierced. Can you imagine the emotion, the feelings of the people at that time? Can you put yourself in that situation? All of a sudden you realize, for the last 50 years, you've lived in the land and you've done it on your own might. Finally, you've been in a situation where there's no deliverance. Perhaps at that point, they'll finally cry unto God like they've never cried unto him before. Please send the Messiah to us. He sends the Messiah. He delivers them. And they find out it's the Lord Jesus Christ, the one that they pierced. And they'll mourn for him as one that mourns for his firstborn. And there'll be a period of time, brethren and sisters, according to the last few verses of Zechariah 12, where there will be some private mourning and weeping as they come to terms with 2,000 years of history that they've rejected their Messiah. That's got to send a shiver down your spine. And you can see then that God brings them through this process, this time of trouble, for that very purpose, that those are the people that will go into the land, if you will, the promised land, the nucleus of the kingdom, the earthly kingdom, the mortal population will be built around those people, God's people, and they will rejoice and be happy after coming through this like never before. And so back in Zechariah 14, That is why God allows this limited success from the invader. But he doesn't allow him to go too far. Verse 3, then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. We'll save a little bit of time here. As he fought in the day of battle, as in the days of old. The passage we took you back there to, Judges 7:22, is Gideon. How did Gideon win the war with 300 people? They broke the pitchers and held up the lanterns. Every man's hand was against his neighbor. That's how it happened. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. We know that Christ and the saints are going to be involved. We'll come to that a little later on in this passage. But primarily, the enemy destroys itself. You can see that if we look over in verse 13 of Zechariah 14. It shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from the Lord shall be among them, and they shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. And Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance. And so shall be the plague of the horse and of the mule and the camel and the ass, and of all the beasts that shall be in these tents as this plague. And so on. So you see, basically, God is fighting. The people are destroying each other. There's plagues and these kinds of things. Now, this is consistent with what we read elsewhere about this battle, which we might call the Battle of Armageddon, as it's commonly known. Go back to Ezekiel 38 now, if you have a marker there, Ezekiel 38. This is consistent with what we learned there, that the hand of the enemy will be against itself. We know Christ and the saints will play a role in this, but as it says in many places, even in the time of David, you know, that those that died from the hailstones or those that died in the woods or whatever was more than David and his men slew. That kind of an idea is here as God fights as he fought in the days of old. Ezekiel 38, 21, and I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother, and I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and I will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon the people, the many people that are with him, an overflowing rain and great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. And there again, you just see God fighting as he fought in the day of battle. And besides all these, what we might call natural elements, how much more that he should send his right hand, if you will, as Christ is there leading the forces of good against these nations. And so verse 4 and 5, we see at this time when there's confusion amongst the enemy, they're slaying each other, there's natural disasters going on, if you will. It's at this time, verse 4 of Zechariah 14, his feet shall stand upon the Mount of Olives. And then certainly there's a tremendous topographical changes here as there's earthquakes, valleys being formed, and this sort of climax, if you will, as his feet stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. We don't have to look this one up either. Acts chapter 1, verse 11 and 12, we know that Christ left from this part of the world, from the Mount of Olives, as his disciples were there and they saw him go up into heaven. And the angel said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus shall so come in like manner as you've seen him go. And how did he go? He left visibly. They could see him go. He left in a cloud of God's glory. He's going to return in a cloud, God's glory, and all the saints with him, the cloud, great cloud of witnesses. In like manner as you've seen him go. It's interesting that, according to Zechariah, it will be in the same place. And his feet touch the Mount of Olives in those days. The Mount of Olives splits. There's a way of escape made for the residue of these people, the ones that were going to come through the refiner's fire, if you will, and accept the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's what verse 4 and 5 tells us there. He will come. We can see at the end of verse 5, the Lord thy God shall come and all the saints with thee. This is consistent with teaching of this time period. We could look up the Joel passage there. It's mentioned in several of those other passages there. I'd like at this point to go to Daniel. It's one we haven't been to yet this morning. Daniel chapter 12. And again, this is an excellent exercise. I hope to do this a little more like a workshop, I guess, with the young people. Because looking for connections, looking for common threads between all the things that we know about the time of the end, and you link that, you know, it's like a big puzzle, and you're trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. Daniel chapter 12 is a place we come and we want to talk to people about the resurrection. Verse 1 of chapter 12, "At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." Isn't that descriptive of what we've just been talking about? A time of trouble such as never was. "Even to that time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found in written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." And so we see that all the saints with thee, thanks, Brother Larry, these resurrected ones that are going to shine forth, they're going to be the kings and priests of the coming age. And that puts in context then for us the location of the timing of the resurrection, and it's in the same time period. If you just glance back briefly into chapter 11, you see that it's talking about the same time period. Verse 41 of chapter 11, Daniel, "He shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, and these shall escape out of his hand, Edom and Moab, and chief of the children of Ammon. He'll stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and the silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps," and so on. And you can see this. We're talking about the same time period. "But tidings out of the east trouble him." Again, God working like he worked in the past, where rumors and noises would just throw the invaders entirely completely off. And it's at this time, verse 45 there, "He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to an end, and none shall help him." And so we can see that the links between all these passages. Back to Zechariah 14, as we need to move on here. 6 and 7 have caused some difficulty, I think, with the translation. Once in a while, we'll read it from the King James here. "It shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light." The margin of my Bible in the end of verse 6 says, "It shall not be clear in some places and dark in other places of the world." That's how it reads in the margin, that phrase, "that the light shall not be clear nor dark." I'll read that again. "It shall not be clear in some places and dark in other places of the world." And so what we have in this time period then is God manifest throughout the world. The darkness is dispelled, and light fills the world. And I've given you some cross-references there, which we don't need to look up, but it's talking about a kingdom time when there will be no need for the sun or the moon, for the glory of God fills the land. And just a little interesting exercise I'd like you to go through at this point. If you just, you don't have to close your eyes, but it might help. If you were to close your eyes, and in your imagination, imagine yourself in a pitch-dark room. Okay, so it's as dark as you can ever imagine. If you've ever been down in a deep cave, you know, the kind of darkness that you can feel. Now, there's one door into this room. And outside, it's a beautiful, bright, sunny day. Okay, so you're in the dark room. It's absolutely dark as you can imagine. Outside, beautiful, sunny day. Bright, bright, noon, sunny day. And someone opens the door. In your mind, have you visualized what's happened? What's happened? The light shines through the door and illuminates the room. Can you imagine that? It doesn't happen the other way. It's almost humorous. Can you imagine if the darkness kind of spilled out and you had the kind of shaft of darkness out into the sun? It doesn't happen that way, doesn't it? I mean, it's almost humorous. Imagine that you open the door and darkness kind of spills out into the courtyard. It doesn't happen that way. The light fills the room. And that's what it's going to be like. That's what it's saying here. It's not going to be dark in some places and light in other places. The glory of God fills the earth. And whether it's physical, which it probably is, but certainly spiritually, the light of the gospel message, if you will, the light of God fills the earth. We long for that time to come, don't we? Because there's lots of dark places. Dark places in the world, dark places in our own lives. We shall be known then as we are known now. There'll be no more darkness anywhere. Let's go on and read verse 8. It shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and winter it shall be, and Yahweh shall be king over all the earth, through the man of his right hand, of course, the man of his appointing. In that day there shall be one Lord, and his name one. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up. Jerusalem shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin's gate unto the place of the first gate, unto the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel unto the king's wine presses. And men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. Whatever it means, brethren and sisters, in Ezekiel about Jerusalem dwelling safely and without bars and gates, and I've given you an indication of what I think that means, certainly it doesn't, whatever is going to be manifested in the last days, whether some sort of peace agreement or peace accord, it'll be nothing like this when it says here, Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. That will be it for sure. God is dwelling there. It will never again be taken. Now, just a couple of things here. The waters go forth to heal the land. We've given some cross-references there in Ezekiel and Psalms and Joel and Revelation to show that, yes, waters will play a prominent role as that temple is established and the waters come forth out of it for the healing of the nation and the trees, the tree of life that will grow there on either side of the street. Christ is set up as king. Ruling on his father's behalf. People submit to his rulership. And as we've said here, Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. God dwells there once again. It will never again be taken. Let's go back to Zephaniah chapter 3. God is dwelling there. Jerusalem will not be taken again. Yes, there will be a time when it may seem like all is lost and it will be overridden again like it was in the time of Babylon or like it was in the time of the Romans in AD 70. Here we go again. History repeats itself and Jerusalem is going to be entirely destroyed. But no, their Savior comes. God now dwells there and it will never be taken. Zephaniah 3, verse 16. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear thou not, and to Zion, let not thine hands be slack. Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. Joshua, Jesus, he will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. And so on. A time of peace. Now, I do believe it will be attacked again. Let's go to Psalm 2. We haven't been to Psalm 2 yet. If you listen carefully to what I said it won't be taken again. God dwells there. He set his king upon his throne. But it will be attacked. It will be threatened. After the nations of Ezekiel 38 have perished on the mountains of Jerusalem, the nations won't be satisfied with what takes place on the earth. Psalm 2, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, this is different than Ezekiel 38, brethren and sisters. Ezekiel 38, the nations are wanting a spoil. It's a political attack. There's no mention of them coming against God and certainly not against his anointed because Christ doesn't reign there. But here, they're taking counsel against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill Zion. I will declare the decree. Yahweh saith unto thee, thou art my son. This day have I begotten thee. And so ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. And so on. Finally, verse 12, kiss the son, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. Brethren and sisters, this is another one where it's amazing how the angels have been at work to bring about what's going to happen. And we look at it now, and it's one of those wonderful things. We can see it. We can see things unfolding that are yet future, and yet the people that are going to be involved in it are absolutely blind to it. I'm not sure if you're aware, you probably are, but Roman Catholic teaching, particularly, and more recently evangelical teaching about a future Antichrist parallels almost identically. I've got a list, I don't have it with me, of at least 10 points what they believe the Antichrist will do and what Christ will do. They believe he will return, will set himself up as a king of the Jews after miraculously delivering them from an invasion, that he'll build a temple, that he'll reinitiate temple worship, that he will set himself up as king of the earth, that he will ask people to come and submit unto him. This is what they believe Antichrist will do. And you can see them here taking counsel against himself and saying, look, and of course believing that it's some supernatural being, we've got to fight against him. And you can see these religions getting together and going up, thinking that they're going to, you know, deliver the world from an Antichrist, when in fact they will be fighting against the Lord and his anointed. And God will laugh at them and have them in derision, certainly. But you can see how that's been set up. That what they'll do is they'll preach to the congregations, look, we've written this. They'll show up your books where they've said, this is exactly what we've said Antichrist will do. There he is. He's in Jerusalem. Let's go up and fight against him, and they'll rally against him. That's the way I see it, and I think that you can see the events of the day today bringing that about. Back to Zechariah chapter 14. So at that point, Jerusalem will be safely inhabited. Verse 12. And this is the plague wherewith the Lord shall smite all the people that fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall be consumed away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. It seems that the earth needs to be cleansed again. Some have read this verse and say, oh, that sounds awful lot like some sort of nuclear holocaust. Perhaps. The point is, brethren and sisters, there's a cleansing that takes place. And I think more important than how this takes place, I think the most significant thing is what takes place. That is that their flesh consumes away, their eyes consume away, and their tongues consume away. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life manifested in a boastful, proud tongue are destroyed. Now, there's a fairly strong suggestion that although God promised never to destroy the earth again with a flood, that is water, there is one standing among you who will purge you with fire. And we've got a couple of references there. Let's just go to the one in Peter. Suggestion that fire will be used to cleanse the earth. And around this area, you all know the devastation that fire can cause. But you also probably know that it is a cleansing agent as well. And at times, even forests need to be burned in order for the new growth to take root. So fire is appropriate. First there was water. Next, when Christ comes, there will be fire. 2 Peter chapter 3. It's interesting in the context of this. We were going to read verse 7. The context is Noah, verse 6, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. Verse 10, but the day of the Lord shall come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away and with great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Now we know, brothers and sisters, the earth will remain. The earth is going to be filled with God's glory. Can you see what the significance of the verse is? The elements therein, the things that make up this earth, will be destroyed and burned. All the filth and the wickedness will be consumed and destroyed. Just like in Noah's day, the earth was still there, although you could say the earth was destroyed by water. The earth was still there. Same for the future. And again, I'm not sure, and I'm not going to be dogmatic, whether it's literal fire or whether this is symbolic of a spiritual cleansing. The point is, that's what's going to take place. And if it takes literal fire to do so, I'm sure God will use it. As we have to wrap things up here, let's just quickly go. We've already read verses 13 to 15. Just a note in your notes there on page 25. This wealth of the heathen round about. We've just got a little note there on the middle of, or just third of the way down the page 25 there. Gentile wealth is used to establish the kingdom. I think that's true. It would be appropriate, like Israel coming out of Egypt. They spoiled the Egyptians, and much of that wealth went towards the building of the tabernacle and the vessels that are necessary. And so we'll see it again as it says there in verse 14 of Zechariah 14, that the wealth of the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold, silver, apparel, in great abundance. And at this point, we were going to go to Isaiah 60. The whole chapter is magnificent. And with this in mind that we've been talking about, read Isaiah 60, the whole chapter. I'd also ask you just to make a correction in your booklets. There we've got verse 13 to 15, little point, Gentile wealth is used to establish the kingdom. And I've given you a couple of references, Ezekiel 39, verse 10, Isaiah 60, verse 9. I would suggest you read the whole chapter, Isaiah 66, 18 to 21. And then I've got Psalm 60, verse 11. That should be Isaiah 60, verse 11. Where in your margin, it says the forces of the Gentiles. And the margin says forces is equivalent to wealth. So it's not Psalm 60, it's Isaiah 60. And in fact, you can just make a little note to yourself, read Isaiah 60 in its entirety with this in mind. It's incredible. Verses 16 to 19, the command goes out, and every nation must come and worship at Jerusalem. Some passages there that we've already looked at, Jeremiah 3. Micah 4 is the same as Isaiah 2 in terms of describing what's going to go on. Christ rules with a rod of iron, and the rebels are punished. So if they don't come up from year to year, they don't receive any rain. That's appropriate. That's the way God's dealt with people in the past. If they're a country like Egypt, then in its pride says, ha, we don't need rain anyway. We have this river. God will send pestilence and a plague upon them. So no one will escape. Christ will rule with a rod of iron. Several references there. If you'll just give me a moment on an aside here. Verse 16, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came up against Jerusalem. In other words, the nations that come against Jerusalem are destroyed. But really, it's just the representatives of those nations that are destroyed. There'd still be their people back in their homeland. Those people, the ones that are left, will come to Jerusalem to worship. Just a little aside, if you're talking to a Jehovah's Witness, they believe in some sort of Armageddon kind of picture. It's a little different. They believe they're coming against the spiritual Jerusalem, and so like Brooklyn's going to be invaded instead of Jerusalem. But the point is, they believe that when the nations come against Jerusalem, that's it. They're completely destroyed. After that, in what they call a paradise earth, it's only believers, i.e. Jehovah's Witnesses. And they live as mortals, actually, on the earth, unless you're part of the 144,000. Anyway, let's not get too far away. This verse, they have no explanation for, because the nations that come against Jerusalem are entirely annihilated according to their teaching. And so all you have to do is ask them what this means. Those that are left of the nations which came against Jerusalem, who's left? You told me there's nobody left of the nations which came against Jerusalem. And they simply don't have an answer. Their little book they flip to won't help them. Okay, so just a little aside there. And finally, the last couple of verses. And in that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them, and see therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. What a picture of holiness, serenity, beauty, no more wickedness, no more Canaanite. Can we read that? No more Jebusite. Jerusalem will be no more trodden down of the Gentiles. The time of the Gentiles has been fulfilled. There's no more traders. There's no more merchandising. There's no more of any of that. The house has been purged. The tables have been overturned. The people have been driven out. And the house of God is a house of prayer for all nations. In conclusion, let's just go to Psalm 122, please. Psalm 122. I was glad when they said to me, let us go into the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is builded as a city that is compact together, whither the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, unto the testimony of Israel, to give thanks unto the name of the Lord. For there are set thrones of judgment, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, and prosperity within thy palaces. For my brethren and companions' sake, I will now say, peace be within thee. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek thy good. Brothers and sisters, we've been looking at Jerusalem this week. The purpose really of the class is, from my perspective, was just to maybe perk your interest a little bit, maybe to inspire you to investigate or reinvestigate, as the case may be, this matter. And if I've done that, then I'm satisfied. We've certainly enjoyed our week. Martha and I are very thankful to you all for your hospitality and fellowship. And by God's good grace, brethren and sisters, may we see you all again next year or sooner in Jerusalem. Thank you.
It's been wonderful to have you here and leading us in these classes. The time is now.